Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Condensed Histories, the podcast that takes pop culture and reveals the real history underneath. I'm your host, Jim Deducciu, and this time round, we have another special guest. Now, they're coming up a little bit later on, and we're talking about jewels. And what's almost metaphysical about this one is I will be talking about the history of jewels, and then we will have a jewel about the elements of jewels. We have different opinions on them. So it is Paul from the History Rage podcast. And what happened was, after we recorded the episode about body snatching, please go back and have a listen to that, Burke and Hare, all that kind of good stuff. It was a lot of fun. But at the end, we started going on about jeweling. This was off the record, and Greg, who was supervising the editing of all this stuff live, well done, Greg.
It was an absolute dream.
He said, whoa, let's actually turn this into another podcast, because you guys really riff off each other well, so you'll be hearing that later on. The sound quality will change. I'm doing this front bit, recording it as normal. So, what is a jewel? Now, first of all, it clearly isn't just one person hitting somebody over the head with something, because that goes back a long, long way. It is a more ritualized form of combat, and it has two distinct origins, one in the West and one in Japan as well. So I'll do the West first, I'll do a little bit on Japan, and then we'll go into the main event of me and Paul talking about stuff and perhaps Greg interrupting as well. Let's take Anglo-Saxon England, although similar things were happening in most of continental Europe. If we're talking about the early era of the Anglo-Saxon age, if we're talking about things like the year 700, 600, that sort of time, it was very much uncentralized government. Indeed, there was no such place as England. It was fragmented into various different Anglo-Saxon territories, such as the Kingdom of Mercia. That's the middle bit of modern England. The Kingdom of Northumbria, that's the chunk at the north of England. Wessex, East Sussex, etc. There are various different territories at various different times. The point here is that even in those areas, they didn't necessarily have full centralized control of them. So if there isn't central authority, there's a breakdown of law. Things are dangerous. And therefore, because of this lack of reliable centralized law enforcement and courts and legal proceedings, there were these very old types of legal codes called trials by combat and ordeals as well. Won't bother going into the ordeals, but an example of trial by combat is, imagine me and you are having a debate about who owns part of this field. I say it's my family's heritage, you say it's your family's heritage. How are we going to decide it? There's no court around. And so there was this ritualized combat. We would have a fight, and whoever won the fight, it wasn't necessarily to the death. Sometimes it was. It could be to just first blood. And that's the term from the movie, first blood. Whoever causes first blood, you know, that's the winner. That's a meaning. Or you drew first blood, now it's getting serious. That kind of thing dates back to the time of dueling and goes back further to trial by combat. Now, even in the Anglo-Saxon era full of superstition, they worked out that if you're a 6'6" bruiser and I'm a 5'2" monk, aged 60, well, it's clear who's going to win this. So you were allowed a champion, somebody who recognized your side of the argument, who was perhaps bigger than you, could represent you in this ritualized form of combat. So the reason why that's something that doesn't happen anymore is because the structures of governance and of the judiciary spread and improved and became more stable over the centuries. Now, what's interesting is there is a movie called The Last Duel, directed by Ridley Scott. It's pretty good. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's pretty good. It's like Rashomon, in the sense that you see the same story told from three very different perspectives, and you have to make up your mind as to who's telling the truth, although the movie annoyingly points you in the right direction, which the original Rashomon, directed by Akira Kurosawa, doesn't. And what it does show, and this is true, is the last example of trial by combat in Western Europe. It's in France, it's all set in France, but it's set during the Hundred Years' War. It was in the late 1300s, and by then, trial by combat had not been a regular form of judicial outcome for centuries. So even to the standards of medieval law, this was an anomaly. This was old-fashioned and indeed a sight to behold. And people, nobody had seen something like this happen before. And it's a pretty good film. 4 stars rather than 5 stars, but it is very good. And the final fight is all kinds of historically wrong, but this was a genuine family, a genuine grievance, and this did genuinely happen, but perhaps not quite in the way that Scott decided to direct it. If you want to know more, it's in my Hollywood and History book, if you want to find out more about that. So the point there is that as courts became the normal place to hear your grievances, things like swearing on holy relics, and we still do that. There is a remnant of that. But the idea was 1,000 years ago that if you were to swear on holy relics, then you really, really meant it, or you could be stricken down by God. And that is why you still pray or swear on a holy book in a court of law anywhere in the Western world. Usually it's a Bible, but people can request a Quran or other religious tomes. So that is an echo of the ancient world. But this idea of, like, I've got a grievance with you, and now we're going to go to combat, starts in the judicial era. But once we get into the full medieval era, we get things like jousting and the melees as well, mass simulated combat. And this would turn into dueling, which really we can talk about the Renaissance era onwards as a format. And it moved from swords into pistols, and that's where I'm sure Paul and I are going to be talking about. Now, going into Asia, we have the samurai. And the samurai lasted from about 1000 AD into the mid-1800s, a remarkably long period of time. Knights and chivalry, by comparison, lasted a maximum of 400 years in Europe. So it's an incredibly long period of time for this martial class. They weren't allowed to be farmers. They weren't allowed to be monks or things like that, although sometimes they might have taken a break and become a monk, but you can't be a samurai monk. That's an oxymoron. But they were the equivalent of the knights in Europe. They were trained, and they were trained in these houses, in these groups, these training clubs. And because of that, it led to people wanting to test their abilities, their skills against other people. Quite often it was with a bokken, which is with a wooden samurai sword. Now, it's still pretty dangerous. You can still crack ribs and hurt people, gouge out an eye or whatever. I have seen places selling bokkens, and it says specifically on them, because they look like a wooden sword. They go, this is not a toy, because they've got enough oomph to them that you can really whack your little sister around the head with it, or something like that. So please do not give them to children. The other form of it is the early stages. Because they were around for 800 years, samurai eras have slightly different rules to them. And from around about 1000 AD to the late 1200s, it was traditional when battle was about to be commenced. So you've literally got thousands of troops lined up against each other. If a particular samurai had a grudge against another samurai, or indeed just wanted to show their prowess, they would call them out. You know, I am Yamagata from House Makada, and I challenge you. And then they would go into the front and they would fight to the death. It's a duel. This actually ended with the Mongol invasion, or attempted invasions of Japan in the late 1200s under Kublai Khan, where clearly you've got the samurai coming out going, I am Yamagata from the clan. And before they could finish the sentence, they would be shot in the throat with an arrow, because that's not how the Mongols fought wars. Although it is worth pointing out there were very few Mongols in the invasion of Japan. It was largely Chinese infantry. But regardless, they came from a different culture. You don't just stand around talking, you just start fighting. So because of that, that's part of the ritual of warfare reduced, but it increased when it came to these inter-house, inter-training departments, inter-dojos, arguments between their skilled warriors. So that's the East and the West summarized as to how we get from cave people banging each other over the head with clubs to a very ritualized, you know, there are rules and regulations to dueling. And there are different countries had different rules about it. And also, there was different forms of agreement as to how serious this would be, like fight to the death or first blood, etc. All these things would be ironed out before the fight actually started. And the classic thing about satisfaction. So I might have wounded them, but I now feel like I have had my satisfaction. I have proven my point. If you like, this goes all the way back to the trial by combat. Because I beat you, I am right. I have won this argument. Really interesting idea that sort of has echoes today. But now, without further ado, on with our esteemed guest. We now got Paul locked into his booth of recording. Hello, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. Well, we liked you so much coming in and talking about how to steal dead bodies that we thought we'd come back and talk about how to create dead bodies.
nicely put. Yes, my other great ludicrous obsession.
So we are going to be principally talking about British dueling. We will talk a little bit about France and our cousins in the Americas as well. But what I wanted to know from yourself, because we've said just off recording, you were talking about how if you look at it purely from a historical point perspective, it doesn't actually make sense. So over to you with your thoughts.
Yeah, okay. So my area of expertise is like the classic Regency early 19th century pistol duel. Yeah, pistols at dawn, 10 paces, turn and shoot, the stuff of Bridgerton and Barry Lyndon.
And Blackadder. As well.
And Blackadder, yes. Dueling with cannons. And which is an interesting point, actually. That is one of the ones that I'll come to. But Blackadder, out of the list that we've given there, Blackadder is actually the most truthful because the Duke of Wellington actually fought a duel.
I seem to remember he only did it once. And yeah, the reputation of what he's portrayed, I mean, Blackadder's a whole other story. But nobody in that TV show acted the way they were meant to. But he did actually do a duel, but he wasn't known for dueling, was he?
No, no. Most people who duel within the United Kingdom, at least, are not particularly known for it. In fact, that's very much the point, because you want to do this quite, you want people to know that you fought a duel, you know, but you don't want to know any more details than that, because it's as much as everybody keeps saying to me, you know, whenever I talk about this or whenever I present it, because out in living history, we do fight pistol duels as well to give the idea as to what's really going on. But one of the great myths is that it was legal. It really isn't. It's never been legal to shoot somebody in this country.
Strangely enough.
Yes, it never has. So this idea that it's legal is complete nonsense. Very difficult to prosecute, yes, but not legal. And therefore, to have the Duke of Wellington fight a duel whilst serving as Prime Minister, and for him not to be the only Prime Minister who's fought a duel whilst serving as Prime Minister, is quite remarkable. The other one was William Pitt the Younger.
But I mean, they weren't Prime Minister, but obviously in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, you've also got Castlereagh and Canning, haven't you, as well?
Yeah, we've got a total of four Prime Ministers who have fought duels, two of which fought those duels whilst serving.
I'm going to leap in here. So I've got to go back and have a look at what things are legal and what things are illegal, because we've had Paul on twice now. I thought body snatching was illegal, and apparently that's fine. But I thought dueling at times was illegal, and apparently no. So I'm really confused now.
Hi, welcome to Condensed Histories, or What Can You Get Away With?
Confused Histories, there we go. Yes, how to commit a crime.
But you were saying looking at it from a historical perspective makes less sense than a psychological perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, when, and I love our historians out there, particularly kind of our academic ones and so forth. But you go in, if you've got a historian brain on, you kind of go in and you're starting to look at sources for what happened. And then you're looking at other sources for what led to that. And you're going along events and times and people and situations. And you're looking at this timeline of how it comes to that. So how you go from this quarrel in an opera to meeting in Hyde Park at 6 o'clock in the morning with a pair of pistols and a couple of friends and shooting at each other. And it's always referred to as honor. And no matter which way you look at it, if you're looking at it like that, it never makes any sense to anybody. You think, why are they fighting this over honor? Why are people being killed over this honor? What the hell is it? And what you don't get when you come at it from a those sort of historical perspective is, I think you get the wrong definition of honor. Now, I'll stress this as opinion here, because what you're looking at, when we think of word honor, we think of chivalry and we think of fair play and we think of cricket and, you know, always bang with a straight bat and being generally British and that sort of thing. That sort of honor. Whereas what actually you should be focusing on is not honor, but reputation. And let me explain in my usual interactive style. Okay, so we're gonna come at something that an insult is offered that may cause some offense, and then we examine at that point how you go from there to ending up pointing guns at each other, risking death. So I'll stress I won't. I'm just using this as an example. But I could wander onto your charming podcast and go, "Good Lord, Jem, your podcast's awful and your books are worse." Now you're going to get quite
how
a
dare thing. You, yes, sir?
Indeed,
I demand satisfaction.
Precisely.
To be fair, his editor says that all the time, anyway.
Shut up, you.
Now you put a lot of work into this, both the podcast and the books, and the, you know, that's the sort of thing, the sort of insult that's going to cut right at your core.
I'm so hurt.
Let me ask you one serious question. Well, two serious questions. Number one, is it worth dying over? And number two, is it worth doing a life sentence in Wormwood Scrubs for the willful murder of me?
Obviously, the answer to both those things is absolutely not. But I would guess, and going to the psychological side of things, because, yeah, every time I've kind of read about a duel, it's like, really? You know, oh, you know, how childish are you? But I think your name, your reputation, just simply meant more 200 years ago than it did now.
Well, yes, because your reputation actually does you a lot more good in those days than it is now. And when I looked at this and I was starting to think, is this worth fighting over? Is this worth dying over? Well, clearly, for some way, it is. Because there are about 800 duels that take part in Hyde Park alone. That's just one park. So there's got to be something there that makes this worth doing.
Well, hang on. Hey, you said 800 duels over what time frame? Because that's important. If it's in a week, that's
a lot. No, it's not in a week. We are talking probably over about 100 years here.
Okay, but that's still...
Dueling is not common.
That's eight a year. That's almost once a month.
Yes. A good sort of 6-7 weeks, there'll be a duel for it, you know, as a general average. Hyde Park is the one where they all go to duel. There are other parks, but that's your main one. But you come at this from the point of view of, right, well, why? Why would 800, well, in fact, 1,600 people go to this park to engage in this thing if it's just for something as casual and ridiculous as honour? And that's when I started to look at, well, actually, what do we mean? And what is the danger of losing your reputation? And once you start to look at that, it becomes a whole lot less bizarre. There are bizarre duels in that, and believe me, I will come to the ones that are pretty insane. But when you look at who fights duels, the bulk, and we are talking about 90% of duels that are fought here, are fought between military officers, particularly army officers, the Navy less so. And that comes down to the same thing that I mentioned when talking about body snatching, money. Another quick question for you. Do either of you have an older brother? Either of you a second son?
I am a second son.
You are a second son. Right then. Well, Greg, you know, you're strutting about Regency London, you know, taking in the world. You're 1801, 1802. You are the second son of how wealthy a family would you like to be coming from?
Oh, well, I'll go all the way. Yeah, I'm upper class, me.
Yeah, proper upper class.
I sounded, don't I?
Right then, yes. So with your stupefying levels of family wealth, you are in line to inherit the square root of virtually nothing. You might have a bit of money left aside, but that family fortune is going to your older brother. So how do you make a family fortune? You join the army.
Yeah.
And how you do that is your father, particularly if you're stupefyingly wealthy, may take you at the age of 14. Now, the age of 13, I got frog marched to the local newsagents for a paper round. Similar, but not quite as extreme. So you get taken by your father, and your father would purchase you a commission in a regiment as an ensign, the base level of officer. Okay, probably about 14, 16, so something along those lines. And you've that commission has been bought. You've become an officer by virtue of buying your way in. Now, what your plan is then is that you start as an ensign, but over the 20, 25 years of fighting with that lovely Napoleonic War that's just round the corner, you can fight with lovely blue-blooded glory, get yourself promoted sharp style up to lieutenant colonel, okay, and then when you come to retire, you can sell that commission.
But you can still buy commission. It doesn't have to be down to bravery. You could just sun yourself in southern India and just keep buying a colonelcy or you know.
Yes, you can. What you can do is you can go in as an ensign, you can sell your ensigncy and promote yourself up to, say, lieutenant, and then you can go up to captain from there and you can buy your way up. But you're not really improving your lot as a second son there. What you want to do is you want to start getting promoted. And it's not just for bravery. It could be just basically being good at your job or being, you know, being a good politician and things like that. The idea being is that you go in at about £300 as an ensign for a straightforward infantry regiment, up to about £800 for to an ensign for something like the lifeguards or the household cavalry or something like that. Okay, and as you go that 20 years, you then go up the ranks. You come to retire a lieutenant colonel, and then you are selling that for about £8,500 if it's a short regiment, as a smaller regiment, or you are somewhere in the region of 12,500-13,000 pounds if you are looking at a lieutenant colonelcy of, say, the lifeguards or really prestigious regiment like that. Now, take that into modern money. You are talking about paying about £8,500 to join the army and selling your commission for the best part of £750,000.
Now, but the other way of putting it into is sort of like you could absolutely get a very large house at the end of all of the, well, you'd have the townhouse and then you'd also have the cottage in the Cotswolds kind of thing.
Yes, and you can buy land with that and you can start other things that will generate income. And it's your way as a second son of creating that family fortune for your dynasty that's going to get them passed down to your first son. Or it is your method of just living the life of Riley so that rich enough to, well, you know, rich enough so that when you go senile, you're actually eccentric and not senile.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Now, here comes the problem, because at any point during that career, if you're considered to be a coward, you're going to get cashiered out of the army, which means basically you get fired and they keep the money. And at that point, you've got no real discernible life skills because you came from your stupefyingly wealthy aristocratic background. Your elder brother has inherited anything. You've got your career is shot because you're not going to get back in the army, even with a commission with a coward's rap under you. You're not going to be able to really inherit anything else. Nobody's going to marry you, so you can't marry into money at that point. And you've got no skills to which to forge any sort of income. So,
When you say nobody's going to marry me, that is a reference to my losing the cowardice. That's not just you looking at my face and going, look, nobody's going to marry you, mate. Come on.
Hey, this is a podcast. They can't see how gorgeous Greg is. But it does get, the way you set this up, Paul, it sounds like Greg remains a vegetarian, is very concerned about animal welfare, but is standing on a pile of corpses of the men who got in his way.
Well, no, it's like, think about it though. If you're going from that stupefyingly wealthy background and you've got, let's say you've got yourself up to being a major or something like that, which is a good commission to be holding on to, even if you can't get yourself the next step up to lieutenant colonel. Something like that. That is a good, you know, you're selling that for £350,000 to £500,000 in today's money. Now, if somebody calls you a coward, you stand to lose all that if the army seems to agree. Now, is that worth risking your life for? Because you could be in the workhouse tomorrow as an aristocrat if you don't do something about this situation. So somebody who's called you a coward, some other people start to think that might have some legs to it. So what do you do? Well, what you do is you call that person out in a duel. That, what do you prove by turning up to that duel? You are not a coward. And this is why so many of them, you see, where they don't actually fire at each other, they fire wide, or they fire into the air, or they just agree that satisfaction has been given. Because by turning up to the duel, you are demonstrating that you are not a coward. And that's the important thing there. Most duels can be drilled down to this one thing. It's the cowardice. There are others about reputation, but the ones that are fought most of all between officers tend to stem from the either direct accusation of cowardice or the inference to do so. And I've got a beautiful example here of just the extremes that somebody needs to go to in order to do this sort of reputation restoration. Okay, so it is a duel fought 26th of May, 1789 on Wimbledon Common. It is a duel fought between a Colonel Lennox and Prince Frederick, the Duke of York, the second in line to the throne at the time. Okay, now, Lennox is a Lieutenant Colonel of the Dragoon Guards, I believe. Okay, what starts this is the Duke of York says that he overheard at his gentleman's club somebody make remarks about Lennox that Lennox shouldn't have stood for. And that's it. Now, from there, can you see that Lennox shouldn't have stood for that? And if he doesn't do something about it, there is your inference in cowardice. Now, from something that sounds to us that trivial, think for a moment what the consequences must be if Lennox is actually prepared to call out the heir to the throne to meet in Wimbledon Common for a pistol duel that nearly kills the prince. Because you're not just looking at being hanged for willful murder there. You killed the Duke of York. You're potentially looking at treason. You know, that is way worse crime there. You know, so to think I could be sitting here being killed, I could be sitting here with a rap for treason, or I could walk away and let this stand. Walking away and let this stand is not the best option for you. You're going to look at that situation and think, actually, what does it take for the best of those options to be actually going into effectively single combat with a member of the royal family?
Yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, it doesn't get much more high stakes than that. And I guess you would have to feel that there is no other option. It's really interesting that you put it that way, because you see it in the news today. If this is my livelihood, I'll do anything to hold on to it. Now, I'm not talking about greed here. I'm talking about, well, as you say, you know, this is my chance of getting married. You know, this is my heritage, my pension, basically. So that makes complete sense. I think I mentioned in the preamble that, you know, we started talking about duels, and because we had sort of slightly different opinions, Greg went, got to come back for this. So when it's interesting, you are only talking about it from the point of view of the pistol era. But of course, you go back 100 years before your era.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Most duels were sword fights. It seems to me, when I was looking into it, the lethality drops down because being shot in the face, there's no recovery for that. And there, I mean, well, of course, a marksman, an officer, you're talking about two officers, they should have similar marksman abilities. Whereas if you're talking about sword fighting, I did actually at university, I fenced for my university. It is the most useless martial art out there. You know, it's like I'm in a bar fight and it's like, all right, then now, fine. Let's create the peace here. All right. You know, a trunk of the body's on guard. Have you brought your saber with you or whatever? I happen to do epee. But yeah, so there's a whole other skill level there. And you can do something like first blood in that situation. It's like my point has been proven. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this situation, you get shot. I mean, there could be gangrene, you could hit a vital organ, all kinds of things. And so it does seem to be a bigger deal in that situation. Let's talk about some of the ones that aren't military. Like I referred to Castlereagh Canning. You know, these are two, imagine, whatever you may think of current politics, it would be very, very weird if two members of the cabinet were so angry at each other, they decided to have a duel. They decided to kill each other. That it's, you know, again, it doesn't matter what flavor of politics you may have, that would surprise you about either Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer.
Either of them actually felt or believed in anything that strongly, I would be surprised.
Anyway. Is it not true, and I'm going to throw this out there, this is something I believe I know, is it not correct that the distance between the opposition bench and the government front bench in the House of Commons is 2.5 sword lengths to avoid duelling in the House?
Yes.
I like that. I also know, and the reason why they all stand up and turn round and bow, that's because in the old days they would have had a sword on them and it would just hit the back of the seat. So that's why they turn round to bow, which is weird. So I guess there's been some potential fisticuffs in the House of Parliament.
I'm led to believe as well, I've not been on a tour, so I can't actually prove this, but I have heard as well that in the members' cloakroom of Parliament, there is still a loop on every clothes peg for people to hang their sword.
Yes,
I don't know how many of them still bring them, but...
Yeah. I think sort of like post 9/11, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to walk around with a sharp piece of metal with all the other politicians in the area. Not a good look. If we are talking about non-military ones, I have an example I want to share with you in France, but perhaps talk a little bit about those. What might be the trigger for those?
So if we take as the one I mentioned earlier, that the Duke of Wellington fights his duel in 1826. Shouldn't know his favourite year for body snatching, but you know, 1826. Now that is courtesy of the Earl of Winchelsea, said at the time, and this is almost a quote, because I'm not going to use parliamentary language, but it'll still be polite. It says, "The man is sowing the insidious seeds of popery throughout every annal of the state." That was basically what Winchelsea had to say about Wellington.
Wrong stuff. Very strong stuff.
For those of you that would like that in English, Basically, what they're saying, what Winchelsea is saying, is that Wellington doesn't actually have the courage to be open about his Catholic emancipation legislation. So he is seeding it in everywhere. Now, there's a couple of things that then see this logically lead to a duel. And it's, again, coming at these issues where you've got to protect your reputation, because your reputation is everything. I mean, okay, while you're Prime Minister, I don't see you going further up the greasy pole, but that might cost you your seat in the Lords if you haven't got the reputation. Certainly if you're a junior backbencher, that cushy job in the Foreign Office you're after, well, you're going to need patronage for that, and that's going to need reputation. Okay, so you're going to need to, and this will come as a shock to politicians today, but you need to have integrity, trust, be dependable, and be of good character. If those go, then your livelihood is gone. Okay, remember, you're not really being paid much as a member of parliament at the moment. What you want is the cushy jobs that go along with those things, that being your livelihood. Now, the first consideration there that ends up leading this to being a duel is that you're saying this to the Duke of Wellington, who is a long-standing military person. You know, so that kind of culture of, you're not calling me a coward, you're not telling me that I haven't got the stones to do this, I'm going to answer that in the way that a soldier would answer that, the way that an officer would answer that, which is then call you out for a duel. Secondly, remember that we have a thing called parliamentary privilege, which means you cannot be sued for libel for something that is said in parliament. So if something that is said in parliament is going to damage your reputation, then you have got no means of legal recourse to actually clear your name on that point. So if you're being inferred as being a coward in parliament by another politician, then you may want to call that person out and therefore demonstrate that you are in fact not a coward. And again, it comes down to this theme that's underlying most of the duels, at least the sensible ones out there, that comes down to this reputation of cowardice, because this is the only thing that the duel proves. You mentioned in the survey, you know, you can do first blood, my point is proven. Well, no, all that's proven is I'm a better swordsman than you are.
Yeah.
If we have a duel over whether or not the sky is green on a Wednesday, if I cut your nose off, it does not make the sky green. It does not make me right. That duel served no purpose whatsoever. And that's the thing. The duel has got to serve a purpose. It's got to be there to restore that reputation. Now, a good example with going out into the civilian world is one of my favourites, the last fatal duel that is fought in Scotland. And this is August 23rd, again, 1826. It is fought between a David Langdale, who's a draper's merchant, who shot and killed his bank manager. And I'm sure I can hear all the respects going up.
Get in line
for him now. Yes, absolutely. We could all salute that. Yeah, he shot and killed his bank manager, George Morgan. Now, what started this dispute was basically Morgan reneged on a loan. He was going to loan Langdale about £1,000 in order to keep like drapery business going, which was going quite well. And then at the crunch time, Morgan rescinds that loan. And at that point, Langdale can't pay any of his suppliers or anything like that. His business reputation is absolute ruins. And so this dispute goes on for quite some time. Yeah, it's not the case with a duel that like an insult happens and the following morning you turn up in Hyde Park with a friend and a couple of pistols and have at it. You know, you are talking about 6 months at least of kind of dispute resolution going on by people. During this time, Morgan's attitude towards Langdale gets worse and worse and worse and worse, to the point where this reaches a peak where he actually horsewhips Langdale in the street. Now, that was behaviour so abominable that actually Morgan's friend refused to act as his second. But from there, he's going, right, well, now I've been shown up in the street. I've got to do something about this. I've been, you know, again, the cowardice coming in there. But I've also got to restore my reputation. This reputation's been so important to me that I need to stand there where, you know, people are aware that I've stood and faced death in defence of this. So I am not some idle person that's just not paying my bills or anything like that. I'm prepared to face life, limb, danger in doing so. And it's quite an interesting duel because Morgan had a long career in the Marines. He was a very good shot, a very good shot. Langdale, the first time he ever held a gun was this duel. He didn't even practice because that would have been unfair. And Morgan missed and Morgan got shot clean through the heart. somewhat accidentally by Langdale. But again, it all comes down to this reputation and cowardice rather than this idea. So Langdale at that point fled the country. He actually came back 7 years later and handed himself in, at which point he was prosecuted for manslaughter, but he was acquitted. Now, one of the things is I haven't as yet gone and looked at the trial record for that one. Trial records at that time can be remarkably hard to get hold of because you can get newspaper reports and things like that. But basically, he is acquitted on the basis of provocation, extreme provocation.
So I just want to, sort of continuing the theory of the, I think it's a very good theory about the sort of reputational side of things. I want to bring up at some point one where we don't know what the causes were, which is really weird, and it's quite an important one in France. But the one I want to mention is it's now become world famous, Alexander Hamilton versus Aaron Burr. Now, you're talking about the vice president of the United States, the sitting vice president, having a duel with a founding father. You know, it is an absolutely insane scenario, which is, obviously, this is shown in the Hamilton musical. And there is actually a song in it called the Ten Jewel Commandments, which goes through 10 stages of, and you made things. It's sort of like, you know, you need to get a second. You talked about just then about, or the previous one with the Duke of Wellington, about the sort of 6 months backwards and forwards, trying to see if there was a way to solve this. And as you say, and Hamilton does a good job of this, it shows you that it isn't like, I'm offended, you know, we're meeting in the forest tomorrow. It goes backwards and forwards. There is a routine and ritual, and it's done in a rap style, a Grammy winning, Emmy, whatever, Tony, it won loads of stuff, Hamilton. But it's really, really good. And it shows you that there are actually multiple duels that were done at this time for various different things. Picking up on your point, it's just it's a wonderful gag. His son, before he dies, his son has to go and fight a duel. They go, where is this duel? And it's just one line in the musical is, it's in New Jersey. Everything's legal in New Jersey. And a number of historians have pointed out, it's like, no, a dueling wasn't legal anywhere. Why do you think it would be legal in one specific state? You know, that's not, you know, murder is not a legal thing. But, you know, it's a good line. It gets a laugh. But yeah, so it's this insane situation that the vice president of the United States shoots him and is then not convicted for anything. Now, I ended up that the weird thing about it was I was writing the American Presidents in 100 Facts and I was reading up about Alexander Hamilton about the same time that Lin-Manuel Miranda was reading about Hamilton. The difference is I thought this is a really interesting story. Even though he wasn't a president, I need to at least get one fact about Hamilton into the book, American Presidents in 100 Facts. Whereas Lin-Manuel Miranda read the same stuff as me and went, I need to turn this into a musical. And that's why he's a genius and I'm not. Because there's nothing in Alexander Hamilton's life where I think you're going to think going, this is full of catchy tunes as he sets up the treasury.
Although, to be fair, if you have seen the unreleased first draft of The American President in 100 Facts, Jem did write the original 100 Facts in rap form and was told...
God bless you there, Greg. But I just have to feel I have to end that even though this guy did not go to prison for shooting and murdering a man, there's this weird thing where he ended up buying a lot of land in the Midwest of America, and there were rumors that he was going to try and set up his own country. So he ended up going to court over treason. Again, he didn't go to prison, but it absolutely destroyed his career. Because are you really going to vote for somebody for president who might have committed treason? That's in no way referenced to this year whatsoever. Honest.
This is the Hamilton Burr duel is a really interesting one, and it kind of highlights this area where things are different in other countries. They have completely different ideas and attitudes. If you go French dueling is mostly about killing your opponent, which is why sword dueling carries on being popular there. And American dueling, well, I'm not even going to comment on the American mindset. Yeah, you know, you have constitutional right to bear arms. It's pointless to have all these guns lying around nobody's using. But Burr fights that duel. Burr wins that duel. And unlike a lot of cases in the UK, doing so absolutely destroys his reputation. He was accused of cheating. He was accused of having practiced. He was accused of Hamilton firing wide and then Burr really taking his time to make sure that he does a lethal shot. There were all these accusations throwing around. This is actually one man who comes out of a duel unscathed. He doesn't improve his life at all.
One weird thing that I've noticed, both in that and in the previous discussion, it's come down to this question that practicing beforehand was somehow seen as dishonourable. Instead of, you just assume if somebody's going into a duel, or I've got a duel in the morning, you know, I might practice first, but that was seen as somehow against the rules.
So again, what are you trying to achieve when you go into your duel? And this is the important point here. It's like, are you going in to survive the duel, which is what you want to do, and come out of that duel as, I am not a coward and I've shown it, okay? Or are you going in to kill your opponent?
Yeah, one's honourable, one's not.
Yeah. Also, one manslaughter, one willful murder.
So by not practicing, you're kind of saying, ah, I just got lucky.
Yeah.
So
it's not about whether or not you kill him. It's about whether or not you've got the courage to stand there and face that. That's the important bit here, okay? And this is why pistol dueling is de rigueur for the UK, because their dueling culture is about protecting reputation and demonstrating you're not a coward. It doesn't actually matter if you kill your opponent or not. It doesn't matter if you wound your opponent or not. You know, in both the examples that I had given earlier on, it's like Wellington and Winchelsea. Winchelsea just fires into the air. You know, the Duke has turned up. He is definitely not a coward. Winchelsea fires into the air. It is also said that the Duke of Wellington fired wide. Now, that could be true, or it could be that Wellington's just an awful shot. Very good general, apparently rubbish soldier.
Yeah, same with Aaron Burr. I mean, he served in the War of Independence, and yet he was a terrible shot. It was known, and therefore the one time he got lucky was the one time he really didn't get lucky, as it were. But just a couple of other points, and sort of bringing it into the world of movies. It is interesting how dueling is shown in the film. So, I mean, there is, and I've already mentioned this in the preamble, The Last Duel, which is actually about the last form of trial by combat, which is a very different thing. But then you've got the movie Highlander, where there's a sword fight and it's played for laughs because Christopher Lambert is immortal. And therefore, this other guy, she keeps stabbing him and he keeps getting up again. And then John Wick 4, it sort of culminates in a sort of quasi-duel. And going back to your point about the practicing, John Wick has spent 2 hours prior to this murdering people with pistols. He has had so much practice that definitely, this is considered first-degree murder. But then again, he's already guilty of creating, I don't know, genocide, because he has killed so many people.
Genocide specifies a race. John Wick kills everybody.
He's an equal opportunity murderer, yes. That's for sure, yes.
You mentioned how it's portrayed in films. I know you're going to be begging me to talk about The Duelists, but I'm actually going to not.
Oh, come on.
Mostly because I haven't actually seen it, but I am aware of the duel that it covers. And I have...
Of course, we're back to swords there, not guns.
Yeah. I have questions.
Oh, so I just sort of briefly jump in there. For people who don't know, The Duelists is a mid-70s movie, and it's Ridley Scott's first film. You could say he's kind of obsessed with it, because one of his most recent films is The Last Duel, and it's got Harvey Keitel in it, and it's set in the Napoleonic era. And a lot of people have said, you want to see the most realistic portrayal of what an actual sword duel would be like, because like people cough and there's false starts and people take their shirts off, because they don't want to sort of like cause extra infection in the wounds. You're either going to get hit or you're not. It's a really good first movie. Simple as that. His second movie was Alien. Anyway, I will kick it back to Paul.
Yeah, it's a good idea of what a sword duel, what a sword fight looks like. The actual duel in question that it's based around was two French officers who, and I haven't studied this one in graphic detail because it's not a British one. It's not so much that they fight a series of duels over like a 10, 12, 15 year period. It's that they really spent 15 years trying to fight one duel that actually ends this dispute. And again, going back to my point earlier, if the consequences of fighting a duel are as immediate and as harsh as is being made out, then you do not take 15 years to fight that duel, because that ship will have sailed. In fact, that ship will have sailed, circumnavigated the globe, and come back with fine spices from the Orient. You know, your reputation is going to... If you challenge me to a duel, and then I come up with some spurious excuse for how we're going to fight the duel, but we're not going to fight the duel for another year, I suddenly look a bit more cowardly than I did before.
You yellow-bellied.
Exactly. But there are a few areas of pop culture that do dueling particularly badly, in terms of absolute howlers. And there are areas...
An example?
Example, one of my favourite films. I absolutely love this film, but the duel in it is almost 100% wrong. And that is the classic Highwayman romp, Plunkett and McLean.
Ah, right. Okay, yeah.
Thumping good movie. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it.
You should see it. It is incredible. Take your historian head off and enjoy the ride.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm just going to throw this out because there's no way I'm going to do an episode on it. Today, I happened to see a movie I've never either seen before or even heard of before. It's from 2016. It's called The Free State of Jones. It's the true story of a bunch of Southerners during the U.S. Civil War who separate from the rest of the South and pro-black people. It stars Matthew McConaughey. A lot of money was put into it. And it was just all like, how have I never even heard of it? But it's a classic example of one of these films that's clearly trying to win Oscars and is so busy being worthy, it forgets to be entertaining or interesting. You know, the two things I managed to get out of it are racism is bad and war is bad. And I'm going to say I knew those two things before I started watching it. But anyway, so yeah. I digress. I just had to throw that in there somewhere.
I'm going to leap in for a second as well while we're all recommending films, because I don't know if either of you have seen this. This one I'm quite sure is completely accurate, but absolute recommendation to everyone as we're talking about dueling is to go online and see a film called The Duel at Blood Creek. It's a short film by a director called Leo Burton. Can't recommend it enough. It is a fantastically funny short film. I'm also popping up with my editor's hat on to say we're looking at the time running long, so moving towards a conclusion.
Okay, I've got one other person I want to say, and then I'm kind of done. Are you okay with that, Paul?
Okay.
Okay, fine. So the one I want to jump back to France, and the saddest duel I've ever heard of is the one of Galois. Now, he just happens to have the same name as cigarettes. That is a complete coincidence. He did not invent the cigarettes. But he was 20 years old when he had a duel. And from the age of about 17, 18, he had shown incredible gifts of being a mathematician. And what's truly tragic about him is he ended up getting embroiled in a duel with a cavalry officer. The thing is, we have no idea why. Best guess, it was over a girl, but we don't even know that for sure. We don't know why he didn't back out of it or anything like that. It wasn't going to affect his career in any way. But the thing is, the night before the duel, he just wrote everything he had in his head down. And he even put in the margin, if only I had more time. It's a desperately sad thing. And it took decades for the mathematical world to go through his just spewing out his thoughts. And it was all right. And, you know, it's like if the guy had just lived another 10 years, he could have launched all kinds of amazing mathematics, potentially perhaps help us in the world of physics as well. But it just wasn't to be. He was cut down at the age of 20 in a duel. That was a pistol duel as well. So, I mean, that's an incredibly sad one. An example of, absolutely, Paul, I absolutely hear you and agree with you on the reputational side of things. But it is also worth pointing out, not every single one fits in that category. And this is another one. This is an example of one where there's a big question mark over again. Huh? And such is life. So,
yeah,
I just had to put that one in.
This is a kind of thing you find when you look into France and dueling, is it makes less sense. And I'll be a hands up, I haven't worked out what's going on in France yet. But staying with the idea of French dueling, though, I did mention that I'd reference some bizarre duels to kind of close. So if we want to close on a little laughable high, I've got, well, basically three that I would think two. So the French one in question, May the 3rd, 1808, it is a Monsieur Grand Prix and a Monsieur de Piquet. And they are French academics of, believe, Paris University. They have a falling out over a girl. And
okay, so far so average.
Yes, exactly. Now, so the challenge is issued and accepted, but they actually state that because they think on an elevated plane, they should settle their score on an elevated plane. So their duel is fought 1,500 feet above the Paris rooftops in hot air balloons with blunderbusses. And you can see how this is going to end.
Awesome. Okay, what happened next?
All right, it's important here because I understand you two are friends, and if I was to call Jem out for a duel, I imagine, Greg, you would be acting as his second, wouldn't you?
No doubt. Do they have extra hot air balloons?
So, well, what happens is that the shots are exchanged, Monsieur Piquet's balloon is pierced, and he plummets. It's actually written in the newspaper report. He plummets 1,500 feet to his death, along with his second, who is in the same balloon with him. So before you accept the honour of being a second, it is worth bearing that in mind. And you mentioned earlier about military officers being good shots. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
No. So we have 1796 in Cobham in Surrey. Now, I don't know what starts this duel, but I do know what finishes it. And it's fought between a Major Sweetman and a Captain Wilson. It's fought in a remote field in Cobham in Surrey. And there is a standard, although this is not standard, what we would consider standard, the 12 paces and turn and shoot. Their seconds are there. Your seconds actually sort of set out everything in the gruel. And the only rules of a duel are what the two principals agree. So they're there at 12 paces apart, and they're ready to present and fire. At which point Major Sweetman calls out, because Major Sweetman is that short-sighted. At that range, he cannot see his opponent. This would be deemed unfair. So he calls out and asks if they can close the distance to a point where he can see. Captain Wilson agrees, the second agrees, and so they close to a distance of 4 yards apart, which is about the length of my living room. Major Sweetman pays dearly for that because he's shot through the heart, clean dead. Wilson is shot in the leg at 4 yards, which gives you an idea of just how bad Sweetman's eyesight was.
Yeah, sorry, that you... Both men should have gone down on that one. That's, yeah, if you shoot somebody in the leg at 4 yards, that's on you.
Indeed. And I'm going to round off with one that probably has no place on a history podcast, that I will explain why. And this is a 1792 known as the Petticoat Duel, a Lady Amelia Braddock versus a Mrs. Elphinstone. And the story goes that over an afternoon tea, Mrs. Elphinstone commented to Lady Braddock the following phrase: "Well, you were a beautiful woman once." Yes, I could see it. When I read that line to my wife, she winced. At which point, Mrs. Elphinstone is apparently ejected into the street, and there follows 6 months of frantic letter writing where she's urged to retract it and she won't, and so forth. And this escalates to the point where the two ladies meet in Hyde Park to settle things with pistols. And so at 8 yards apart, they take their shots. The first shots are exchanged. The first casualty is Lady Braddock's hat that is shot clean off. At which point, the seconds intervene to try and get a reconciliation. However, no reconciliation is coming forward, so the ladies pick up swords and have at it with swords. At which point, Mrs. Elphinstone is wounded in the arm and consents to write a letter of apology, and they both go their separate ways. Brilliant, isn't it? Unfortunately, I cannot corroborate this in the least. I'm not saying it's a lie. Okay, but I can't find coverage of it anywhere. It is mentioned in almost every book on dueling that I have, but I actually cannot corroborate that back to any sort of source. I can't even find trace of an actual Lady Almeria Braddock.
Yeah,
there's Elphinstone's first name. It's not there.
It's all too good to be true, isn't it?
It is
a great one to finish on.
It's a lovely story, and I will always tell it. But I will always throw that caveat in there.
And let's just be clear, we're not saying that it's not real. We're not saying it is real, because I know that one of Jim's biggest problems he's faced as a historian was the time he said King Arthur wasn't real and took an awful lot of backlash. So we're not saying this isn't real. Don't come at us.
Yeah, if you are a descendant of either of these ladies, we'd probably like to know that. Thank you very much. Please corroborate. That's all it is. But look, Paul, as always, you've been an absolutely fabulous guest. Thank you so much for sharing these marvelous stories and adding a different angle to the podcast. Thank you so much. And to everybody else, there'll be another podcast coming out soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.